From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, what to do if you're caught in the middle of a firestorm? Peter Leschak is a freelance firefighter who battles forest fires in the North Woods and the West. He's not a smoke jumper, he says. He's a grunt, hiking to remote locations, putting out fires sometimes on his hands and knees, spark by spark. Leschak's new memoir is called Hell Roaring. Also, a video diary of the hard reality of life in North Philadelphia. Frank Cardone is one of three teenagers who was given a video camera for a year to record his daily life. His footage is part of the documentary Teen Dreams. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews VR5, the new series about virtual reality on Fox. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton ate lunch with elementary students in a Washington, D.C. suburb today. He used the occasion to criticize Republican plans to move the federal school lunch program and hand it over to the states. Mr. Clinton says the GOP wants to take money from children and use it to fund a capital gains tax cut for wealthy Americans.
This is hardly what I call putting people first. This will advance not the economic interests of the middle class. It will not restore the American dream. It will not help the poor to work their way into prosperity. It will simply achieve some short-term gains in order to finance either spending cuts or tax cuts to upper-income Americans.
Republicans say their plan actually raises spending for school lunches and that states can run the program more efficiently. They say this means more meals at lower cost. The House is working on a controversial part of the Republican package to revamp the legal system. The measure pits corporations against trial lawyers and consumer groups in product liability cases. The bill replaces current state laws with a uniform federal law. It limits the amount of punitive damages that can be awarded. Supporters say expensive court cases hurt consumers in the long run since they must pay higher prices for goods. Opponents say corporations must be held accountable for unsafe products, and the GOP bill will jeopardize health and safety for consumers. British officials are dismayed over President Clinton's decision to invite Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams to the White House next week. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The president invited Adams to a White House St. Patrick's Day party and also lifted a previous ban on Adams' fundraising while in the U.S., so long as the money goes to purely political activities. Adams has made three previous trips since the Clinton administration first granted him a visa last year over British objections. But this will be the first time the president has actually met the Sinn Féin leader. The announcement had been anticipated in London, but British officials have nonetheless complained anonymously to reporters about the White House move. They know very well what our view of the IRA is, one official told Reuters. Still, the British government has itself made overtures to Adams in the last few days. Specifically, they've softened earlier demands that the IRA give up its large stockpiles of weapons before government ministers will meet face-to-face with Sinn Féin. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
The Clinton administration is mounting a strong defense of the dollar. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin says the administration will do whatever is necessary to protect the dollar's position as the world's principal reserve currency. These are the strongest remarks yet since the dollar started falling to record lows against other currencies a week ago. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 6 points at 3,985 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq has risen a fraction of a point to 795. This is NPR. There's been a claim of responsibility in the deaths of two Americans in Pakistan. Someone called the Associated Press Bureau in Manila the Philippines and said, "We are the Liberation Army." The Washington Post is reporting senior Clinton officials think yesterday's ambush was meant as revenge for the extradition of a World Trade Center bombing suspect last month. Police in the Philippines believe that suspect had been in Manila in January to conduct terror activity. The Washington Post is also quoting an administration official who says one of yesterday's victims in Karachi was an undercover intelligence agent, but that apparently was not a motive in the attack. Major League Baseball has two new teams. Baseball owners have awarded expansion franchises to Phoenix and Tampa, St. Petersburg, Florida. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
The Tampa Bay Devil Rays and the Arizona Diamondbacks will begin play in 1998. Tampa St. Pete has been trying for years to get a franchise, even building a baseball stadium 5 years ago without a team committed to the area. The new clubs each will pay a $130 million expansion fee. That's $35 million more than Colorado and Florida paid only 2 years ago in the last expansion. Despite the fee and despite the seven-month-old strike, Tampa Mayor Sandy Friedman welcomes baseball to her city.
There is a lot of disgust, and people are tired of the strike, and they want everybody to get back to playing baseball. But nevertheless, people realize that by the time this team takes to the field, that all that's going to be behind us, and that they want to look forward.
Baseball officials say there could be even more expansion in the near future. I'm Tom Goldman reporting.
A storm has knocked out power to more than 100,000 customers in the San Francisco Bay Area. Up to 2 inches of rain have fallen in some areas. Forecasters say three separate storms should pour between 3 and 5 inches of rain along the coast this weekend. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Last summer, 14 members of an elite team of firefighters were killed as they battled a blaze that had engulfed South Canyon, Colorado. Winds of 50 miles per hour turned a controllable fire into an inferno that overran the firefighters, scrambling to escape its destructive path. Peter Leschek is a freelance firefighter who works out west fighting wilderness fires. He's part of a team of foot soldiers who work on the ground, performing a kind of hand-to-hand combat with the blazes. This is seasonal work since big western forest fires only happen when the weather is warm and dry. When Peter Leschek is not fighting fires, he's at home in Minnesota, where his other seasonal work is writing. His books include Letters from Side Lake, A Chronicle of Life in the North Woods, The Bear Guardian, Northwoods Tales and Meditations, and his newest, Hell Roaring, The Life and Times of a Fire Bum. He writes that what attracts him to fighting fires is both the madness and the fellowship. I asked him to describe the madness.
Well, I guess there's an anecdote that might clarify that. Back in 1989, for instance, I received a phone call in the middle of the night as, you know, you're rarely ever dispatched at a reasonable hour. And the dispatcher here in Duluth actually asked me if I was willing to go to a forest fire in California, and I said absolutely. And I showed up at the airport at the appointed hour, and the plane took off, and we landed in Boise, Idaho. And, of course, everything had been changed in mid-flight, and the beauty of it is you never know what to expect. It can be a totally chaotic environment. And, of course, uncertainty is the spice of life. It's the only thing that makes life interesting, actually. And so there's always that suspense, what's going to happen next. You wake up in Minnesota, you go to sleep in Wyoming.
I would think, though, that there's nothing ambiguous about fighting a forest fire.
Actually, there is quite often an ambiguity there. You know, on the face of it, you know, I guess we've been told by Smokey Bear and you know, you name it, the culture in general, that fire is an evil thing. And that when you are combating fire, you are fighting this evil entity, which isn't the case at all. For instance, there is always a measure of, well, not always, but quite often, a measure of doubt. Should this fire be put out or not in the wildland environment? For instance, Yellowstone in 88, as anybody who's around will recall, was this huge a media event, and of course the tenor of the coverage was, you know, we're losing our national treasure, and it became a huge political football. And there were 10,000 of us firefighters there for about 2 months, and frankly, if there had only been 5,000, the outcome would not have been different at all. And in retrospect, the fires, more often than not, had a positive impact on Yellowstone. A lot of the ecosystems around this nation, most of the forest ecosystems, are fire-dependent.
Well, explain to us the kind of equipment you need, you take into fighting a big fire. I mean, for us city dwellers, we're used to the fire truck pulling up, attaching to the local fire hydrant, and spraying it with water. When you're out in the middle of the wilderness, what do you take with you?
Well, you know, there are a lot of variables there. It depends on where the fire is. A big part of wildland fire, unlike municipal firefighting, is that we use aviation resources quite a bit. You see a lot of helicopters. You see a lot of air tankers. Those are the huge twin-engine or four-engine aircraft that dump retardant on the fire. And one of the things that continues to amaze me after all these years is the huge logistical problems that you run into. You know, as I mentioned, we had 10,000 firefighters at Yellowstone, and keeping those people fed and equipped can be just a monumental task. And it depends on what branch you're in. If you are doing helitech, that is working with helicopters, or if you are with an engine crew using fire engines that would be fairly familiar to city dwellers, or whether you're on a hand crew, which I do quite often. It's a 20-person crew, and you go into the fire, hike in, or flown in via helicopter with hand tools, shovels, an axe-like tool called a Pulaski, and basically dig. You dig fire line, or you grub out burning stumps. Perhaps there's a water source, and you haul in hose, and you fight it with nozzles. A huge tool of firefighting is ignition devices. You know, you fight fire with fire. The old old proverb, and you can do that by dropping fire, literally napalm, out of the sky, or you can do it with handheld tools called fusees or drip torches, and of course chainsaws are a huge item on fires. But on a hand crew, you spend a lot of time hiking. In fact, I've often looked at some of these Western fire details as sort of a paid camping trip to keep the morale up.
Is there a kind of hierarchy in the firefighters who put out wilderness fires?
There is a hierarchy in the Forest Service. I suppose at the pinnacle of that hierarchy are the smoke jumpers. Those are the people who parachute into wildfires, generally small wildfires. You know, there's only about 400 of those people in the entire country. Next comes what they call the hotshot crews, and they became a little more well-known as a result of the Storm King Mountain fire in Colorado, because there was a hotshot crew that was involved with that fire. And these are 20-person crews who, at least theoretically, have more experience and are at a higher level of training. Then you have helitech crews. These are firefighters assigned to helicopters who are delivered to the fire via helicopter and support the helicopters. And then you have what are called Type 2 crews. These are hand crews, 20-person crews, who are at a lower level of experience and training. So there is a pretty definite hierarchy there.
And the hand crew, these are the people who hike up the mountain. And
these are the people you see in the news reports who are basically almost always digging. It's very, when you really get down to the nitty gritty, it's sometimes very unglamorous work. And sometimes, you get really get excited to get the fire dispatch, and you get all your gear together, and 24 hours later, you're somewhere you've never been before, digging fire line and wondering why you were so excited.
Well, explain to us what it's like to approach a big fire in a forest. I mean, let's imagine you're hiking up a mountain and you're approaching this fire. What do you smell? What do you see? What do you hear?
Well, if I'm going to be really true to my profession, what I smell is money. We are very, when you are totally dependent on the weather, and when you're dependent on what amounts to seasonal work, you find it difficult to be upset at the notion of a fire. And sometimes we feel ourselves somewhat out of sync with the general public, because they're being told this horrible, horrible event is going down, and all we see is a paycheck, some adventure, and some travel.
And you make pretty good money, do you not?
Oh, not at all. In fact, I'm sure most middle-class Americans would be appalled. For instance, when I go out on a hand crew, my basic wage is around $8 an hour with no overtime and no hazard pay. And the only thing that makes it even remotely worthwhile financially is the fact that you get, you rack up perhaps 300 hours in 3 weeks. And the pay is low, partially out of tradition, because during the Depression days, there was a phenomenon called job hunting. And, of course, times were tough, and people realized that if they went out into the woods and started a fire, that the Forest Service or the BLM or whoever would be looking to pick up some firefighters. That's what they used to do in the old days. They would basically empty the saloons or the highways or whatever and send people out into the woods to fight fire. And so a ready source of income was to go light one up and get on the payroll. As a result of that, a lot of agencies deliberately kept firefighter wages low. And they got into the habit of bringing crews from as far away as they could to discourage the local people from lighting up the woods. And so that tradition has sort of carried over. You know, a lot of people are shocked to learn that smoke jumpers, I mean, these are the elite, these are the people who parachute, you know, into forested mountains, which is just mind-boggling. And they are very well-trained, highly skilled individuals who risk their lives just about every day. And most of these people are getting $9 or $10 an hour.
Gosh, so it isn't the smell of money, it's the smell of hard work.
Well, there is a lot of hard work. There is travel. There is adventure. And, of course, you know, the money is significant. I wouldn't do it for free. But, you know, the federal government might be spending a lot of money in a lot of areas, but they're not spending it on firefighter wages.
Well, let me ask you, because I set my kitchen on fire about 5 years ago and pretty much burned it up. And once I got everybody out of the house, I ran back into the house to make sure I'd gotten all the animals out. And I went into my kitchen, which is just the average size kitchen, and the cabinets were all on fire. I mean, the whole thing was on fire. It was so loud. And I'm trying to imagine what the sound of a huge forest fire must be like.
Well, last summer, I was in Washington on a hand crew. It was the Taiyi Fire, which was one of the biggest ones last year. I think it finally made it to about 127,000 acres. And the conditions were so extremely dry, and the fire behavior was so outrageous that you know, we were being literally pushed all around by that fire. And at one point, we were on a dozer line, a line that had been gouged out by a bulldozer, and we were basically improving that line. And we were unaware that there was some fire building below. And the classic description of it as it builds and it races up the mountainside is of a jet aircraft. Mm. You know, there was no mistaking that sound, and it really is quite a horrible sound when you understand what's coming up the hill at you. And it can be incredibly loud.
Are you afraid when you're fighting a big fire? Are you conscious of being afraid?
Sometimes, you know, most of the time, I think the fear comes beforehand. You know, as I sit around in the wintertime thinking about the things that have been or the things that could have been, I think you get a lot more nervous then. When you are directly involved, and if you are at a certain level of training and experience, you're usually just too busy to be directly, you know, concerned with the notion of fear most of the time. And, you know, obviously sometimes panic can be a part of it. But most of the time you're just too busy. And then afterwards, you know, you kind of sit down and you think about what might have been, and then perhaps you start to get a little shaky.
Well, I want to talk more about fighting fires, but first we have to take a very short break. My guest is Peter Leschak, and he's a traveling freelance firefighter, and he's written a book about fighting fires in the American West. It's called Hell Roaring, The Life and Times of a Firebum. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with firefighter Peter Leschak. Are fires predictable in any way? And I'm thinking about the difference even between a fire started by lightning and a fire started by humans who were irresponsible with a campfire. Does it make any difference how a fire was started in its effect on how it burns?
No, the determining factor is, well, there are so many variables. And, of course, weather would probably be the chief one. I mean, what's the humidity? How dry is it? You know, how windy is it? What are the slopes? You know, one reason that there are so many huge fires in the West is because of the component of slope. And slope is basically artificial wind. And so fires move very quickly and furiously, you know, upslope. It depends on where it was started. For instance, if it was started near homes, the response is going to be a lot more aggressive, perhaps, than if it's just out in the middle of nowhere. But, you know, a fire ignited by any means is basically the same. I mean, unless someone was to use some sort of incendiary means and spread a lot of fire along a wide front. Here in the East and to a certain extent in the West, you get a lot of railroad starts where a long train with perhaps what they call hot brakes is throwing off sparks. And you can have a train set afire, you know, continuous fire for miles. And then, of course, you're into a very serious situation very quickly.
Is there a most dangerous aspect of a fire? I feel almost silly asking this question, but I'm thinking about smoke. I'm thinking about the actual fire itself. I'm thinking about falling trees. I'm thinking about trees that even explode from the heat. Is there something that a firefighter has to be most vigilant about?
Well, you mentioned one of them that we worry a lot about, and that is falling trees, or as they're known in the trade, snags. And a snag is any dead standing tree. And of course, if a particularly hot fire rips through some forest, it's going to leave a lot of snags behind. And I remember one night at Yellowstone, we were supposed to go into a stretch of burned out forest there and do some mop up. That is, clean up the remnants of the heat. And it was windy that night, and we could literally hear the trees falling almost constantly. And so we just didn't even dare go in there. The particularly wicked things about a snag is that it can fall almost, soundlessly. It can just pull out of the ground. The roots are burned off. The soil has perhaps been disturbed. And it can just tip over without a sound. And there's not much you can do about that. I mean, if it sort of has your name on it, you're all done. And I know a lot more firefighters who have been seriously injured or hurt by snags than, say, have been burned to death. And if you look at the statistics, the casualty and fatality statistics, another big killer is vehicle accidents and aircraft accidents. And relatively few firefighters are actually killed by the fire. Last year's incident at Storm King was probably an exception.
What about the grizzlies and snakes that wait for you at the camp?
Oh, yeah. the animals are always a concern. And in fact, there's some pretty bizarre things have happened over the years. For instance, at a fire in California, I think it was in the late 40s, a burning marmot ran across the fire line down slope and ignited a fire below the firefighters and killed several of them. And that doesn't happen terribly often, but it's one thing you keep an eye out for, a burning rodent crossing the line. And, of course, you better stop it if you see one.
Are you aware in a big forest fire that animals are being burned to death?
Yes, but it doesn't happen as often as you would imagine.
Really?
At Yellowstone, for example, is probably some of the most outrageous fire behavior of the century. I suspect it's the biggest fires I'll ever see. I mean, it looked like the end of the world. When the North Fork fire blew out on Black Thursday, we happened to be in a helicopter just north of there. And as I recall, the smoke column reached up like to 50 or 60,000 feet and flattened out and made its own lightning. I mean, that's how huge of a column this was. And it ran like 14 miles and it burned up 40,000 acres in an afternoon. And yet, in spite of that, I think that the animal casualties, say the elk casualties at Yellowstone, numbered less than 200. Animals get out of the way. I mean, especially if they live in a fire ecosystem, they know what it's all about, and they get out of the way.
What's the most dangerous situation you've ever found yourself in a fire, where you really felt this was it?
One was at Yellowstone in 88, and I detail it in the book. We ended up, because of the shortage of hotshot crews, the Type 1 crews, most of them were in Alaska that year. And of course, that tells you something about the Yellowstone politics, because although Yellowstone was definitely a serious and huge fire, there were bigger ones in Alaska in 1988, but nobody cared. So because of this shortage of hotshot crews, our crew, which is a Type 2 crew, which was considered of lesser ability, was put into positions we would normally not have been. And we were at the head of the Hunter Fire near Shadow Mountain in the Bridger-Teton National Forest, and came as close to being overrun probably as I would care to be in those circumstances. And the fire came right up to our line, and several trees exploded in just huge showers of sparks, like a blizzard of sparks, and they just rolled right over our heads behind us into very dry grass. And so we had two crews there, basically 40 people, and we were just on our hands and knees just grabbing these embers in our gloves and snuffing them as fast as we could, realizing that if we missed even one, that had the chance to just to turn that whole meadow into fire, and we would be in a very poor position.
What is the effect of women firefighters? And as you write about it, there are more women firefighters who are showing up at these big forest fires.
Yeah, there has been, particularly in the federal organizations with affirmative action programs, a lot more females are showing up on the fire ground. And, in fact, I ran into a crew back in Idaho in 89 that was completely made up of female Alaskan natives, and although they did have a white male crew boss, and we kind of gave them some kidding over that. But my attitude toward female firefighters is that they are just like the males in that there are good ones, there are bad ones, and there are so-so ones. And I hope that I do not have a particular gender bias. To a large extent, and this is another huge attraction of the fire ground, to a huge extent it is a meritocracy because, one, you can't hide out there, and two, a lot of people simply aren't willing to put up with incompetence because there's so much at stake. So a lot of people who don't belong out there, or at least in my estimation don't belong out there, weed themselves out. You know, they come there for a season or half a season, and they're gone.
Do you have any permanent scars, aches, and pains based on fighting fires?
Well, on a structure fire a few years ago, I tore the cartilage in my knee, and of course that was a surgical operation, and most of my injuries are from other things and are simply aggravated by fire. Since I am now going to be 44 in a real hurry, I can't fake it anymore. And so, unlike the 22-year-olds and the 24-year-olds, I have to work out constantly, and I do it year-round. In the winter, for instance, I try to put 500 miles on my cross-country skis. I continually do stretching exercises and strength-building exercises. The best strategy is always to prevent it.
Well, the fire season is starting soon. Are you getting itchy?
Oh, yes. I've been sort of primping my gear already.
Waiting for the phone to ring?
Yeah, here in Minnesota, we're still pretty much into winter. We had, in fact, a snowstorm just the other day. But when we get into March, the snow starts to go, and generally our fire season here is April and May. And yeah, I have to admit, I'm really looking forward to it. I heard a long-range forecast the other day that said we might have drought conditions, and I have to admit to a little perverse glee.
Have you ever gone back to visit a site that burned just to see what it looked like? You mentioned Yellowstone earlier.
Oh, yeah. In fact, one consequence of fire here in northern Minnesota, if it's in the right ground, is that sooner or later it may create a wonderful blueberry patch. And when I go looking for blueberries in the summer, if I happen to be around, it's something I really like to gather, I go back to the old fire sites, and that's where I might find the blueberries. And one thing that has really impressed me when I go back to places where I have fought a fire is the rejuvenating power of fire. I mean, that's why it is such a huge part of the ecosystem. Fires are natural fertilizers of the forest, and forests as we know them, could not exist without fire. And, we have really upset that balance because we have come in with, huge logging operations and all sorts of other forest management practices. But probably the original forest manager in most cases was fire. And for instance, in northern Minnesota, we have the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. It's a 1.2 million acre wilderness area. And I've done some research on that. And before the white settlement, that whole area burned over on the average of every 120 years, except for the wettest bogs. Since white settlement, we have upped that every 2,000 years. And so in one way or another, we have had a huge impact on that, or will have a huge impact on that ecosystem by keeping fire out of it. And I'm not sure that anyone knows how that's going to turn out.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I thank you very much, Peter Leschek, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty.
That's Peter Leschek, author of Hell Roaring, The Life and Times of a Fire Bum. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Frank Cardon used to carry a gun, but now he says his weapon is a camera and his voice. Coming up, we hear from Frank Cardon. He's one of three teenagers across the country who was given a video camera to record his daily life for the documentary Teen Dreams. Cardon lives in North Philadelphia. And TV critic David Biancooley says he has another reason to stay home now on Friday nights. Fox Television's new series about virtual reality, VR5. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak have discussed the stalled Mideast peace process and Israel's failure to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. They held a news conference after their two-hour meeting this morning. NPR's Suni Khaled reports.
Secretary Christopher said that for all countries to join the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty was an important goal of the United States, but he said it would be unlikely for Israel to sign it until there was a comprehensive peace in the Middle East. Christopher made the statement at a press conference with President Hosni Mubarak following 2 hours of talks with the Egyptian leader. Egypt has recently stepped up its demands that Israel sign the Nonproliferation Treaty, destroy its reported arsenal of nuclear warheads, and open its nuclear facilities to international inspection. President Mubarak said negotiations with Israel on the matter were continuing, but he once again called for the Israeli government to come up with a timetable for compliance with the Nonproliferation Treaty. I'm Suni Khaled in Cairo.
The White House says President Clinton has approved a visa for the leader of the political ally of the Irish Republican Army. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams will be able to enter the United States to raise funds for his organization. The funds must be spent on political activity and not on weapons. Adams and Protestant religious leaders will also be invited to a White House reception on March 17th, honoring St. Patrick's Day. The government of China has sharply rebuked the United States for spearheading an effort to criticize China's human rights performance. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
This week, for the first time, the UN Human Rights Commission voted on a resolution that criticized China's record. The resolution was narrowly defeated, but U.S. Assistant Secretary of State John Shattuck was heartened anyway. He told reporters in Geneva that China has used procedural maneuvers in the past to prevent such resolutions from ever coming to a vote. But this year, with U.S. prodding, a majority of countries demanded a formal vote. It's a signal, Shattuck said, that China, like all other countries, is bound by universal standards of human rights. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman called it gross and unacceptable interference in China's internal affairs, and he warned that the U.S.-China human rights dialogue would be harmed. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
House Republicans are putting off a vote on a constitutional amendment for term limits. House Majority Leader Dick Armey says it won't come to the floor as planned next week because there aren't enough votes to pass it. He says a vote is more likely later this month after leaders rally more support. There's a split in the GOP on the amendment. Two Republican leaders oppose the bill. Majority Whip Tom DeLay says term limits just transfer power to unelected bureaucrats. Ohio's John Boehner, who chairs the House Republican caucus, says he will also oppose the amendment. On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow rose 4 points to close at 3,983. Declining issues led advances by a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Major League Baseball has approved expansion clubs for the cities of Phoenix and Tampa, St. Petersburg, Florida. It's believed the owners will add two more clubs by the year 2000, and Orlando and a Virginia suburb of Washington, D.C. are bidding for them. St. Petersburg has been ready for baseball after building a stadium in the 1980s. Seven previous efforts to land a team had failed. Phoenix has a new ballpark on the drawing board. A former First Lady has told a House panel that the current national leadership has lost its drive in the war on drugs. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
A frail-looking Nancy Reagan told the panel she doesn't like to leave California because of her problems at home, a vague reference to her husband, former President Ronald Reagan, who has Alzheimer's disease. But she says her heart pulled her to Washington because the nation has forgotten the anti-drug message she spearheaded with the help of famous movie stars and athletes.
Where is the widespread consensus that was backing the children up and giving them the motivation and skills they needed? How could we have abandoned that?
Democrat Curtis Collins, who represents part of Chicago, says it's true drug use has risen in this country the past few years, but says casual drug use is down. Collins adds just saying no just doesn't cut it in urban areas. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
The astronauts aboard the space shuttle Endeavour are searching for evidence of the origin of the universe. This is the second week in space for the Endeavour crew. The scientists aboard are pointing three telescopes at a quasar that's 15 billion light-years away. Astronomers say if they can find intergalactic helium, it may possibly validate the Big Bang theory of the beginning of the universe. There's a new U.S. mission underway to find the fate of Americans missing in action in Southeast Asia. The U.S. Embassy in Thailand reports Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary James Wold flew to Laos today. This is the first part of a trip that will take him to Vietnam and Cambodia. He'll join a U.S. Laotian search team that is looking for Americans missing in action. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Several years ago, filmmakers Peter Kanoi and Ilan Ziv found three young people, one in Los Angeles, one in Philadelphia, and one in New York City, who wanted to document their lives through video. The teenagers were trained in video techniques and storytelling, given a Hi8 camera and a year to come up with a film about themselves, their family, and their neighborhood. These video diarists had input into the editing process as well, and the result is a raw and unsettling glimpse into the hard reality of life for many adolescents today. Their documentary is called Teen Dreams. It was screened at this January's Sundance Film Festival. Frank Cardone is one of the young filmmakers. His chapter in Teen Dreams is a look at the violence in his Philadelphia neighborhood and the daily lives of Cardone and his friends. Frank Cardone made this film when he was 18 years old. He's now 20 and is working as a freelance producer. He told me what it was like to pick up a camera for the very first time.
It's like, it was strange. It's like a cartoon, you know. It's like you can feel the power, you know. It's like, wow.
Just like that?
Just like that. You can just feel it. You have an understanding of what you have, you know. It's like you aim it at people and you catch them, you know. You catch them. And it's like, it was great. We would tape each other, you know. We'd do some funny stuff, you know, silly stuff, and we'd watch it, you know. We started, like, messing around with it, you know, like doing different things with it, you know. I had a buddy, Mac, and he loved it too, you know. And he was like, that camera was like, you know, it was something we had. At first, people were scared of it. Hey, don't bring that around here, you know. But then it got used to it, you know. That's just Frank with his camera, you know, doing
his third
thing.
Eye, right?
Yeah, his third eye. He's out here, you know, doing what he wants to do, what he loves to do, you know. So it became part of us, you know. And that was great.
Very few people get to tell their story to other people. Were you self-conscious at all? Did you feel nervous at all trying to tell people who you are?
Not really. It's like most of my life, you know, nobody ever heard me, you know. Nobody ever took the time to listen to me, you know. And this was a way for me to talk to people, you know, talk to people, tell them what I was feeling inside, you know, how I was feeling about what was going on in my neighborhoods, you know. And it was a great opportunity. And you're right, very few people get this opportunity when more and more youth should get this opportunity to speak out, you know.
Tell us about the neighborhood that you live in North Philadelphia.
Well, I used to live on 13th and Pike with a friend of mine, David. It was kind of festive, you know. It really was. It was like friends out there, always out there together, you know. It was a sense of togetherness. And if you didn't come from there, you wouldn't understand it, you know.
If you didn't come from there, would it look festive and friendly?
No,
would it look
really
scary?
It would look scary, you know. And that's something that's really obsessed me, because, you know, the media puts out these images and people just, you know, judge before they get to know, you know. And there, for me, I lived there. I knew the people. It was great, you know. It was family, you know. Everybody knew everybody. It was a community. But for an outsider, it wouldn't have been a community. It would have been a scary place because of the images put out there by the media, you know.
In the beginning of your film, you talk very directly to the camera and you say there are three things that make Frankie: hatred, anger, and fear. You also go on to say that hate is part of survival where you live. What do you mean?
It's like, I grew up really, you know, hating things. I didn't like people, you know, for the simple reason that I kept getting hurt, you know, by people. You know, it's like my school teachers would put me down, and police officers would humiliate me, you know. it really tore me apart. It really tore me down. It kept me at a level where I had no ego, and I hated myself, you know? And at the same point, I started hating other people, which gave me the strength to just do the things I had to do to survive in situations that, you know, in other circumstances, I wouldn't have been able to.
How did you get the impression? What did your teachers do or say that made you think they hated you?
There's countless times. I had a teacher actually once in Florida, Miami, where I went to school for a little bit. Actually get in front of the class and tell the Hispanic students and the black students that half of them would be garbage men or the other half would be on welfare, you know? And this is a teacher. This is an educator, you know? And what gives this person the right to tear these young children down, you know?
Did you think that at the time?
I didn't think that. I believed her, you know? I believed this woman. I was like, well, damn, you know? I don't want to be a garbage man. I don't want to be on welfare, you know? But she's telling me that's what I'm going to be. And in another instant, a teacher directly towards me said, you know, I was a troublemaker and I would be in jail or dead by the age of 18. And, you know, and I don't see how you can just, at this moment, then I believed her, but at this moment I can't see how an educator, a teacher, somebody you're supposed to look up to, could tell a youth something like that, you know?
Were you a troublemaker?
In a way, I mean, I wasn't really a troublemaker. I spoke up for myself, you know? It's like I was a person that spoke up for myself. I didn't let people take advantage of me, but in school they consider that a troublemaker.
Did any teacher reach out to you?
There was one, I'll even say her name, Mrs. Enstrom. She was an English teacher, and she was in Virginia. That's when I went to school in Virginia at Byrd, and she was great, you know? It was like she told me what was up straight from the door, you know? She was like, this is what you got to do to make it out here, you know?
So she was tough.
She was tough, but at the same time, she didn't put me down in the way she was teaching me, you know? She would, like, you know, let me know what I needed to do, you know? Told me, you know, it's like, you're not a bad person. She told me, you know, I wasn't a bad person, you know? It's just that things happen. And that's what kids need, you know? And I needed that. And it was great for that one moment, you know, that somebody did that for me, you know?
How far did you get in school?
I got to the 10th grade.
Why'd you drop out?
I really didn't drop out. It happened in Fells High School here in Philadelphia. A teacher had me arrested for assault. It happened one day in school. I never touched her. And I spent like a month in prison because of this person, this educator. And when my court date came up, she didn't even show up. She wrote a letter and it said it was a case of mistaken identity. And the school wouldn't admit the wrong they did, and they wouldn't let me back into school, you know, even though the case was thrown out. The teacher wrote a letter saying it was a case of mistaken identity. Yet I lost everything I had. I was left out in the streets. This is when I became homeless. I was left out in the streets, and this teacher never admitted, you know, to my face what she had done. You know, she was never confronted about what she had done. I was a young person. I didn't know my rights. I had no power, and this teacher took full advantage of that, you know?
So what, you were about 16 years old?
I was, yes.
You had no family?
I had no family at the time, no.
Who had you been living with up in Philadelphia when you were in school?
She was like an aunt, you know, but she wasn't a blood relative. When she found out I was arrested, she really went off the wall, and that was it, you know. She kind of kicked me out, you know. Not kicked me out because I left, but that was because of pressure she was putting on me. And it was just the thing, nobody believed me, you know. Nobody believed me. I was this brown kid at school. I was I was a troublemaker. Nobody believed me. And yet this, you know, at the end, I was right, you know. And nobody came and admitted it, you know. It was like nobody came back and said, hey, you know, we're sorry, you know. It was just like, let him go his own way. And I was homeless from then on, and I lived on the streets.
How did you survive on the streets? I mean, you were pretty young at the time.
Well, you know, like, there was very limited options, you know. I did things, you know, that I'm not too proud of, but I'm not going to say, hey, you know, I was wrong, because I had to live. If you have to choose between starving to death and not having a place to live and living, you're going to choose to live. And that's what I did. So I don't blame myself for what I did, you know.
What did you do?
I was selling drugs at the time, and I was doing other things, and it was just lucky that I found people that cared enough to pull me out of that.
My guest is Frank Cardone. He's a freelance filmmaker, lives and works here in Philadelphia, and his story is a story in a new documentary, actually, which had a airing at the Sundance Film Festival. It's called Teen Dreams. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Frank Cardone. Tell us about growing up in Miami. You were born in Miami?
No, I was born in, actually, Santiago, Chile. I was not born in the United States.
Okay.
But most of my life was spent, like, in New York, Miami, and here in Philadelphia. Miami was, you know, it was pretty, because the gang activity was real there, you know, it was real. There, it's like you could see your enemy, you know, your enemy lived on Davy Street, you know, or your enemy, you know, was three blocks down, you know, and it was like, you didn't know what you were fighting for, you know, all you knew was, yo, they're my enemy, you know, why, I don't know, you know, and it was like, it may have been something that happened years and years before I was born, but the anger was still there, you know. And I lost my brother through this, you know. He was like a person that took care of me, man. Excuse me. And
what happened to your brother?
He was killed in a drive-by, and you know, it was a lesson, you know. It was a lesson in life. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore, you know. I don't want to have to live like this anymore, you know. It's like I could have been killed that day too, you know.
How old were you at the time?
It's really fady, you know. It's like I don't know. I guess I block it out, you know, but I was real young, you know, and I was around 12 maybe.
How old was your brother?
He was around 19, going on, I think, around 20. And, you know, it was just what happened was just a simple, like, turf, you know, situation. It's like, this is our area. What are you doing here? And, you know, it was just, you know, hectic, you know. I really don't want to get in. Yeah, I was. I don't really like getting into that too much, you know.
But you saw him get killed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were your parents?
Well, I never really knew my parents, you know. It's like, that's an area I can't even, you know, answer too many questions on. It's like, I never really knew them.
Let me ask you, after your brother was killed, and you said you were about 12 years old, who took care of you? Where'd you live?
I took care of myself, you know, I had people down here in Philadelphia that I lived with, you know, again, like aunts, but they weren't really aunts, you know, not blood related. You know, friends I started living with, you know, people just moving from house to house. And finally I found a permanent house, you know, it's like with a family. I have a family again, you know.
This is in Philadelphia.
This is in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. And that's with Willie and Joni Baptist. They're like my mom and dad, you know. It's like they were my guardians. They took care of me, you know. And it feels great, you know. It's like it's, you know, it's just something I can't explain. You know, you feel so alone most of your life, and all of a sudden these people come into your life, you know, and they're there for you, you know, and they're teaching you. They're not just there for you. They're not just feeding you or, you know, like giving you a place to stay. They're teaching you at the same time, you know. They're like educating you. They're giving you books to read, you know.
My guest is freelance filmmaker Frank Cardone. He lives here in Philadelphia, has his own video company called Guerrilla Video Productions, and is part of a documentary called Teen Dreams. Let me ask you about an incident that you talk about in the film where you're driving with some friends and someone goes into a store to get some food and a friend gets shot.
Yeah, I saw this, you know, and I was young, and I saw this, you know, and I saw two lives destroyed that day, you know, the person that did it and the person that got it, you know, and over words, you know, and I don't get any counseling for this, you know, and nobody takes that into account, you know, it's like, well, you know, hey, that's your own problem, kid, you know.
But what you say to the camera or the impression that you leave is that you start to rethink the times that you've used a gun, the times that you've carried a gun, and you begin to even question these friends of yours and how safe you actually feel with them.
it's not really questioning them, and it does recap a lot of things that I went through in my life. It's like, imagine, you know, not only me, but every time I've seen somebody shoot, this is the damage they've done. You know, they've taken a life, you know, regardless whether they're just somebody from the streets or whether there's a police officer or whether there's just, you know, a man being a vigilante. Somebody thinks they're doing their American duty. They're taking a life, you know, and it's like most likely it's a life that a person that was never, you know, listen to, a person that nobody listened to, a person that nobody cared about, you know, and but that was a life, regardless of whatever, you know, and it's so easy to kill these kids, and it's not right.
Do you still carry a gun?
No, I don't. I don't carry a gun anymore.
Why not?
It's like I've learned another, I have another weapon, and that's my camera and my voice, you know. My camera, that's a weapon. You know, the camera is a dangerous weapon. It could be used, you know, it's a destructive weapon. I can use it to build stereotypes, or I can use it to tear down stereotypes. And my voice gets me out of trouble. It's like I talk now. I'll be like, yo, you know.
So do you feel safer with or without a gun, with or without a camera?
It depends on the situation. You know, it's like, I'm smart now. If somebody, you know, came up to me with a gun, I'm going to do what they say. You know, it's like, hey, you know, you have the power right now. I'm going to do what you say. And hopefully they'll have find it in their heart not to, you know, take me down. But with the camera, I do feel very safe. When I have my camera, I go into a situation with total confidence, you know? It's like, I have this little power, you know? It's like, I'm not going to let, you know, happen to me things that you've done to other people because I have this power now. I can prove it to the people that, hey, this could happen, you know? It's like, you know, the camera is a weapon, and I'm using it to the best as I can.
When you go walk down the street, when you go to a mall, you go into a store, how do you think you're seen?
I'm still seen as, you know, this criminal, you know. I'm seen as a person that shouldn't belong here, you know. I mean, just outside here, you know, the lady had a little trouble letting me in for a minute there. I had to say I have an appointment, you know. But it might be the way I dress, you know, but that's me, like I said. But once, that's the thing. Once people get to know me, it's like, hey, you know, do you have a friend, you know. And it's like I can understand how people are out there. There are a lot of bad people out there, you know.
So when people look at you with some kind of either suspicion or disdain, how do you deal with that now?
How do I deal with that now? Is, mm-hmm. You know, if they look at me that way, hey, let them, you know? And it's like maybe one of these days they'll take the opportunity to come and talk to me, you know, instead of just looking at me and making a prejudgment. They'll be like, I want to find out what this guy's truly about. And that's when things are going to start getting better for all of us, you know?
You like yourself?
I love myself, you know? I'm a beautiful person.
Well, Frank Cardone, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
You're welcome. And thank you very much for having me here.
You're welcome, too. That's filmmaker Frank Cardone. His story is part of a new documentary called Teen Dreams. This is Fresh Air. We're joined now by Linda Wertheimer to tell us about All Things Considered. Linda, what news do you have for us?
Marty, we are looking at the House Republican tax package, which was unveiled today, the tax cuts promised in the Contract with America. Also, we'll be following the fall of the dollar and following it right down to Tennessee, which is where I am. We will talk to a Japanese economist who teaches here in Tennessee and heads the U.S.-Japan Economics Partnership, which is very active here. Also, politics in Tennessee, a new Bible will be published here in the summer. We'll talk to a Christian musician, and we'll go to a Meet 3. It's a special kind of place to eat.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Friday night on Fox, the network premieres its newest series, VR5, starring Laurie Singer as a computer hobbyist. TV critic David Bianculli says it's the perfect lead-in to The X-Files and has this review.
In the TV series Fame and in the Robert Altman movie Shortcuts, Laurie Singer played the cello. In VR5, she plays the computer. More specifically, she plays a character named Sydney Bloom, who accidentally figures out a way to insert herself into any virtual reality landscape of her choice. She can't control what happens once she gets there, but she can take other people with her by calling them up and hooking her phone to her computer modem. During the premiere episode, Sydney calls the hospital and asks the nurse to put the phone to the ear of her mother, who has been catatonic since Sydney was a little girl. Sydney launches the virtual reality mode, and presto, Sydney and her mother, played by Louise Fletcher, or back in the comfortable setting of their old family home, having a conversation for the first time in about 15 years.
How is this possible? It's like I can bring another person into my dream. I create the setting, but I can't control what happens in it. When I wake up, I'll remember everything, but the other person, you'll just remember the feeling.
You've tapped into the subconscious.
I think I have.
How will we get out?
I have to find the escape key. It's just something I touch. It's connected to whatever I'm doing.
Well, this is incredible. Who are you working with? I hope you're documenting everything. You should show me your notes. Psychiatry is my field, you know?
Yeah, but it wasn't an experiment. It was just an accident, Mom.
Then we'll study it together.
Can't we just talk?
That's what virtual reality sounds like on VR5. But what's really important is what it looks like. Sydney's subconscious, and the imagination of the show's writers, is wild enough to make room for all sorts of bizarre costumes and settings. And the color in each scene is manipulated by computer so that everything looks a little creepy. I've never seen anything quite like it, not even the groundbreaking visual styles of Twin Peaks and Wild Palms. But what's most exciting about VR5 is that it has somewhere to go with its gimmick. The series comes from John Sackrett Young, who created China Beach, so the characters here are much deeper than the ones in your average sci-fi series. So is the plot, which unfolds each week in a continuing storyline. By the third episode, the scripts have risen to the level of the visuals. It turns out that Sydney's dead father, played in flashbacks by David McCallum, was an early VR pioneer, and his past holds the secret to how Sydney can do what she does. And Sydney, because of what she can do, gets recruited by a mysterious organization known as the Committee, a nasty group that could just as easily be assigning and hampering the investigations of Scully and Mulder on the X-Files. By episode 5, VR5 has deepened and darkened even more, to the point where the Committee turns on Sydney and captures and tortures her to learn what she knows about virtual reality.
Did your father ever experiment on you? On your sister?
What?
Did your father kill your sister? Did he try to kill you too?
If you just thought of The Prisoner, that classic cult series starring Patrick McGoohan, so did I. You might say it's virtually the same show, but with a female protagonist and drop-dead special effects. VR5 and The X-Files are two great reasons to stay home on Friday nights. Or at least, to set the VCR.
David Bianculli is the TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Sienna Chrisman and Zeb Esselstyn. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, the new movie Outbreak opens. It's about a highly contagious and deadly virus and the team sent in to contain it. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from Richard Preston about the deadly Ebola virus that came frighteningly close to causing a real epidemic in Reston, Maryland in 1989. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.